From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour has been made 5 years in a row in Albany. Each year, a single-payer health care bill has passed the New York State Assembly, and each year, it has stalled in the New York State Senate. Advocates for state-level single-payer systems believe that they now have the opening to get it done in New York. On the national level, President Biden and Vice President Harris continue to call for strengthening the Affordable Care Act. President Biden has been touting recent surveys that find consistent support for the individual provisions of that law. Americans like it and want to keep it and want to build on it, the president says. That stands in contrast to some in his party who want to move to a national single-payer system, as many other countries have done. Call it Medicare for All or something else, but President Biden does not prefer it. He wants the ACA protected and improved. And so with the political left at a bit of an impasse on this in Washington, state-level progressives are looking at what they can do. And that's why there is a renewed push for a single-payer system here in the form of the New York Health Act. This hour we'll discuss whether that door is truly open now, and why advocates are more optimistic than they have been in years. Welcoming them now, Michael Marshall is a volunteer with the Rochester Poor People's Campaign, the Rochester Homeless Union, and Metro Justice. Michael, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Evan.
And Mahima Iyengar is with us, a medical student and co-chair of the Rochester Campaign for New York Health. Mahima, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us on.
Let me ask both of you just how you view that landscape right now in New York State, knowing that nationally, and we'll hear some of the president's comments in a moment on this issue, but in this state, Michael, does this feel within reach to you?
Very much so. And at this point in time, as we go through a pandemic that is impacting everyone throughout the entire world, the nation, and in the state of New York, there's a real need for medical coverage that's not tied in and linked to for-profit organizations or tied into whether or not you're employed. So it seems at this point in time, as we're looking at over 500,000 deaths, looking at vast unemployment within the country and in the state of New York, universal health care would be a big bonus for everyone.
Mahima, how do you see it right now?
I think the same as Michael. I think that the time certainly seems like now. If the pandemic the pandemic has made things, I think, clearer than ever before for people in the state of New York. As Michael was saying, we shouldn't be having health care tied to employment. And I think the pandemic has made that very clear. And I think that the current legislature is kind of well poised with a lot of progressives who believe the same thing that we do. So I think we're at a very critical point for the bill.
Next hour, we welcome new members of the legislature from our delegation here, State Senator Jeremy Cooney, Assemblyman Damon Meeks, and they're going to talk about a wide range of issues, and I suspect this will come up as well. But Mahima, to your point there, for the last 5 years, this has been able to get through the Assembly, but the Senate has been sort of split among more progressive Democrats, sort of centrist Democrats who often align with Republicans. That has all changed now. Do you think some of the reason that voters have decided to install a more progressive state Senate is this issue? I mean, is this a powerful one with voters, you think?
I think that this is definitely powerful among voters. I think that if you go out into the communities and talk to people, everybody knows somebody that has a story about the healthcare system and how the healthcare system has failed them or someone close to them. So that's what we do with our campaign. We go around and we talk to people and we listen to their stories. And I think that this is an issue that really resonates for people. And I think the past year has shown that we really need to make a change. And I think people are ready to start moving on this issue.
Yeah. And listeners, if you want to share your thoughts and experiences, one of the aspects we're going to be talking about this hour is maybe some of the lessons we've learned on healthcare during the pandemic. Although, to state the obvious, this has been a conversation and a point of advocacy for many years, long before the pandemic. It's just a matter of what has been put into stark relief in the last hour. Also, if you're wondering, you know, sort of where is the Biden stance on this, it's not all that easy to bring in kind of more centered Democrats who prefer building on the current system as opposed to a single-payer system. And some of the polling bears that out. I'm going to get to that coming up here. But we are interested, if we can do that, in having those conversations, and we're certainly interested in conversations about other proposals on other forms. This is just a look at what advocates for a single-payer system are working on in this state. And the Rochester Campaign for New York Health and Metro Justice are launching sort of a renewed focus on supporting the New York Health Act. They're rolling that out next week. And so that's part of why we're having this conversation this hour. But if you want to join the conversation, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994, or you can email the program connections at WXXI.org. I've got a couple of pieces of sound I'd like to play, and I think we've got both ready to go. We're going to grab them in just a second here. So they are President Biden and Vice President Harris. These are some of the remarks they made recently about their desire to see the Affordable Care Act entrenched, strengthened, protected, and to become not only the national healthcare system, but one that is really supportive of Americans everywhere. And they believe that that is the way to go, not to transition to single-payer systems. So President Biden first spoke about this just days after his election, when he was trying to make sure that, well, he was trying to sort of galvanize opinion and public support around what the Supreme Court was looking at. This was back in November, just around the time that, a week after the election in the Supreme Court, there was a lot of speculation the Supreme Court was going to find a way to throw out the Affordable Care Act. They did not. Here's what President Biden says. Oh, we're going to put them together. So we've got Harris and Biden together here. Let's listen to the vice president and the president talking about the support of how they view the country and why they're sticking with the Affordable Care Act.
We just had an election in America, an election where health care was very much on the ballot. Our country had a clear choice in this election. Each and every vote for Joe Biden was a statement that health care in America should be a right and not a privilege. Each and every vote for Joe Biden was a vote to protect and expand the Affordable Care Act, not to tear it away in the midst of a global pandemic.
I'm not naive about the fact that health care is an issue that has divided Americans in the past. But the truth is, the American people are more united on this issue today than they are divided. Recently, as last month, a leading survey found that American people want to keep the Affordable Care Act in place by an overwhelming margin of 58% to 36%. 79% of the American people, including 9 out of 10 Democrats, 8 out of 10 independents, and 2/3 of Republicans, want to keep the ACA protections for people with pre-existing conditions, which would be eliminated if this lawsuit were to succeed. This doesn't need to be a partisan issue. It's a human issue. It affects every single American family. We can't subvert the growing consensus of the American people.
Those are Vice President Kamala Harris, President Joe Biden, talking recently about what they think Americans want. And interestingly, the president refers to polling, which has its murkiness on this. Let me just read a little bit of the polling, and then I'm going to ask Michael and Mahima to respond to some of what they heard, and then we'll start working through your phone calls. But the polling is murkier than the president sort of suggests here. Yes, he's correct that if you ask Americans directly, do you want to keep the Affordable Care Act, a majority will say yes. And then if you look at the individual provisions that the ACA rolled out, if you just ask about the details of the law, not the name of the law, there is a pretty strong support for a lot of them. But then if you ask about how Americans compare healthcare systems, take a look at this. This is from September 29th, 2020, so just a few months old, the brand new polling from Pew on Americans and healthcare coverage. Here are some of the headlines and some of the details. A majority of Americans continue to say the federal government has a responsibility to make sure all Americans have healthcare coverage. And since last year, there has been an increase in the share of Americans saying health insurance should be provided by a single national program run by the government. Among the public overall, 63% of U.S. adults say the government has the responsibility to provide healthcare. That is up from 59% last year. So 59% at the outset of the pandemic, 63% now. American adults say, yes, it's the responsibility of the government to provide it in some form. When asked how the government should provide health insurance coverage, 36% of Americans say it should be through a single-payer program. 26% say it should continue to be provided through a mix of private insurance companies and government programs. That is a change from 1 year ago, pre-pandemic, when nearly equal shares said single-payer 30% and a mix 28%. So since the pandemic began, you have 6 percentage points more of Americans favoring single-payer, and a drop in percentage points of Americans favoring the current mix to where a plurality of Americans now support single-payer. So it's a murkier picture than the president paints there. Let me ask Mahima to start. What do you make of what you heard from the president and vice president?
So I guess I just want to start off by saying that the Affordable Care Act has certainly decreased the number of people that are uninsured, but we still do not have a health care system. We have a profit system. The number one cause of bankruptcy in the U.S. is still medical debt. And so regardless of, I think the polling language, I think there is like a general sense from like the polls that you have read that people realize that the system that we have isn't working for everyone. And I think that we are seeing like the trends move in a really positive direction. I think more and more people are realizing that the insurance industry is really kind of playing a middleman role here that's extracting profit off of our sickness and illness.
Michael Marshall, what do you think?
Well, I think in terms of that question, the statements that the president and vice president posed, yes, elections do have consequences, and yes, healthcare is a human right issue, and it shouldn't necessarily be framed in a cost analysis, strictly speaking. And I think when you're looking at those statistics and those polls, the difference might be accounted for in terms of the amount of people who've been unemployed, the amount of people who have actually had to rely and turn to our healthcare system during this pandemic. I personally, as a Black man, contracted COVID in November. And because of my economic position and status, the only way I was able to receive treatment was I was on Medicaid. And if I hadn't had the access to Medicaid, I would not have been able to get the ambulance trips, the doctor visits, the tests that were required, and all of the various treatments that I received over a two-month period. So I was very fortunate in that I was able to be covered under that safety net. But not all Americans are fortunate in that respect because they may not meet the poverty guidelines, or they may have worked their entire life and then played into an insurance plan that doesn't actually cover various tests or various procedures. So they're actually underinsured. So I think Americans are coming to an understanding that they would need comprehensive coverage for all Americans.
And interestingly, Michael, you're saying healthcare should be a right. The president is saying healthcare should be a right. The vice president is saying healthcare should be a right. The difference is they want to maintain a system that you seem to think if healthcare is a right, there's no way you can achieve what you want to achieve under this system. Is that how you feel about the ACA?
Well, what I see in regards to the ACA is that it was implemented under President Obama. And for the last 12 years, the federal government, predominantly on the Republican side, has spent 12 years trying to dismantle it and break it apart and tear it apart. Nowhere did anybody come in and step in and say, these are policies that we can implement and change and improve the Affordable Care Health Act. So they've had 12 years to make amendments, to make adjustments, but they have not actually been successful because they've been fighting in the courts, in the legislative body, just to dismantle something that clearly the American people want. And I think one of the reasons the New York Health Act is so pivotal is because it is becoming from a state level. So, for example, in the Affordable Care Act, it was modeled after the Massachusetts plan for health care. So I think if you look at it on a state-by-state basis, each state can tailor and implement policies that fit their needs. That was done in Canada before they went to universal health care. They actually started with one province and worked it and tailored it and, fine-tuned it to meet the needs of the country as a whole. One of my favorite anecdotes from the internet is that so many years Americans thought that Europeans lived longer and healthier lives because they drank red wine and ate chocolate. Come to find out, all of these European nations all had universal health care systems. And perhaps that might be why they're living longer and healthier lives.
What do you got against wine and chocolate, man?
I think they're wonderful in moderation.
I hear you. Let me get Arseny on the phone first. This is Arseny in Rochester. Go ahead, Arseny.
Yes, I absolutely. Thank you so much for speaking on this issue, and I'm definitely in support of the New York Health Act. I think we really need to pass it this year. I wanted to ask two questions to the guests. One question is about the racial disparities in the healthcare system, and certainly, as Mahima mentioned, we've seen an exacerbation during the COVID pandemic. We've seen these disparities become even clearer than they were before the pandemic. And so I wanted to ask you to comment on how you think the New York Health Act might help to address some of the issues with access, especially getting rid of some of the racial disparities with that. And then secondly, there's a lot of attention being brought to the problems of mental health and policing. And certainly with the Daniel Prude case, he was failed first by the healthcare system and then by the policing system. And maybe you can comment on how you think the New York Health Act would help to create more preventative and mental health access prevent some of these situations from occurring in the first place.
All right, very good. A lot there. Thank you, Arsenia. And let me turn to Mahima first, if you want to take that. Go ahead, Mahima.
So I'll try to answer, I guess, both. So I think that we have a very underfunded preventative healthcare system, a very underfunded primary healthcare system, and that I think certainly leads to this disproportionate impact on both Black and Brown communities in the state and low-income folks in the state more generally. And so with the New York Health Act, I think this goes back to your previous point, that this truly prioritizes healthcare as a human right, and that care is comprehensive and is offered to everyone, and everyone is under the same system and covered equally. So primary healthcare, preventative healthcare, and mental health care, dental, hearing, vision, these are like all things that are covered under the bill and would make care more accessible and more equitably distributed to folks in the state. And I think this would have a very, very large impact on like health disparities that we see in the city of Rochester. And I think that, focusing on preventative health care really helps kind of reduce illness and illness down the line, which I think ties really, really well into like the current COVID crisis and how we talk about with people with comorbidities and other diseases having higher rates of COVID.
Okay. Michael, do you want to add to that?
I do, because as I said earlier, being a person of color and having recently overcome COVID, first, I would just like to take a moment and I would really like to recognize all of the healthcare workers in New York State, in Rochester in particular. I had ambulance drivers, I had medical technicians, I had nurses and doctors, I had people from Rochester Regional calling me on a daily basis to check on my status and my health and progression. So I would like to thank them for all of their hard work that they did. But as a person of color, I learned a tremendous amount about our healthcare system. It became very evident to me when I saw statistics that said I was twice as likely to contract the virus, 2 to 4 times as likely to die from the virus. So this became a really real life issue for me in terms of how I was treated and the care that I got. And again, I am very thankful that I had this privilege to be on Medicaid, but not for that, I really could have been in a position of my life at risk, not being able to take an ambulance, not being able to get the help. And I think the issue of how race plays into this is that with the comorbidity, if you're not treated in early stages of your life to have preventative care such as diabetes or heart and high blood pressure, those things will later in life impact your overall welfare and health of the individual. So people of color have been under a very disparaged health care system that hasn't treated them well to begin with. And then as we come into issues such as this pandemic and the virus, then you are actually at a greater risk. And if you don't have a health care system that never met your needs in the first place, you really are in a vulnerable position and at the mercy of this for-profit healthcare system. So I really think there's a lot to be said about the intersectionality of race and health care. You know, for example, Mahima talked about the mental health situation. If people were able to receive mental health counseling and support services and they were available, maybe they wouldn't escalate and get to a situation where you have a young girl being yelled at and attacked on the street and being, you know, accosted by 10 police officers. Maybe if there were people in human services, social services, or the mental health field that could have helped that family along the way, we may not have gotten to that point in time where it was broadcast and played out on the streets of Rochester.
Talking to Michael Marshall, a volunteer with the Rochester Poor People's Campaign, the Rochester Homeless Union, and Metro Justice. Mahima Iyengar, who is a medical student and co-chair of the Rochester Campaign for New York Health. This is a conversation about where things stand on the state level with the push for the New York Health Act. That's an act that for years has passed the Assembly but has not been able to get through the New York State Senate. And this conversation focuses on why those dynamics seem to be shifting and what could happen this year here. Let me get back to your phone calls. Robert in Rochester. Go ahead, Robert.
Hi. I wanted to know the best way to influence state senators to get this law finally passed. I've been advocating for a single-payer system not only in New York State, but nationwide for as long as I can remember. And it just seems to be very frustrating. It's obviously very frustrating that it can't get passed in the Senate. That seems to be the roadblock.
Yeah, in this state, Robert, it certainly has been. Though I will also add, Robert, I mean, Governor Cuomo has not been very receptive to a single-payer system either. But I think you're right. Legislatively right now, the block has been the New York State Senate. So I appreciate that call. And let me ask, I'll start with Mahima Iyengar. When you think about what happens next year, I know that there's a new campaign ramping up. The Rochester Campaign for New York Health is ramping up starting next week here. How do you aim to sort of make a breakthrough with a legislative body that has not been receptive for years?
I think that we made some really great breakthroughs in the past couple of years. We've been electing a lot of really great progressive champions in Rochester specifically. And so I think I have high hopes for this bill in the upcoming legislative season. And specifically, Robert, to answer your question, we'll be having a press conference next week on March 5th, where we're going to be announcing some hopefully like exciting updates from like the citywide level about this bill. That'll be March 5th at noon. And, you know, the statewide campaign is a really large campaign that's been fighting for this issue for a really long time. There's the nurses unions involved. There's a lot of different groups that have been involved in this issue at a statewide level. And so I think that, you know, more and more groups have been getting involved in the recent year.
Michael, are you an optimist now that things are turning in the same way Mahima's talking about?
Very much so, because as an activist, I feel that at this point in time, the citizenry of the state of New York and of the United States are collectively gathering, becoming informed and educated, and making their voices heard. I personally was on a call this morning with statewide elected officials, and I heard what their concerns and issues were with regards to how do they get information, how do they understand the impact of collective groups coming together and, you know, making their demands heard. And I would say this, I'd say that it's very important that people continue to write letters to the editor. I think it's important that we stay in contact with our local elected officials and our statewide officials by phone calling, by petitioning them. And I would also just like to say that it needs to be clear, they work for us. We pay their salary, and we as a constituent body have a right to have our needs met. So when we put forth the idea that we want something like a single-payer health plan, it's not that we're wishing for pot. It's that we have real bread-and-butter needs right here, right now. As I was saying about this medical coverage, I had a friend that just recovered from pancreatic surgery, and she was going through 2 years of chemotherapy. Now, she had been employed in the Postal Service for her entire life, so she had great health coverage, but then it got diminished and cut down and cut back, and so her co-pays and her out-of-pocket expenses increased. And after her surgery. She had to get medication because she lost most of her pancreas, and she went to go pick up the pills, and they were $500 for her prescription. Now, why this medical information wasn't shared with her prior to trying to purchase this, I don't know. But I do know this. She's underinsured, and she can't get the medicine that she needs to stay healthy and to survive paying into this system. So people are cognizant and aware of how important it is that we have comprehensive coverage, whether it's with prescriptions, whether it's with preventive care, and all facets of medical treatment. I think people are very much becoming conscious and being outspoken with this regard.
All right, Tom, Lisa, let's keep going through phone calls. I'll squeeze in one more before the break, and then Lisa, hang there. We'll come to you right after. Tom first. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to talk about the clip you played, Kamala Harris, because I think it's a really strong example of why it's frustrating as a progressive to deal with centrist Democrats. She said that every vote for Biden and Harris was a vote in support of the ACA, and that's factually incorrect. A lot of those votes were a vote against Trump as president. During the election cycle, you're going to say to progressives, look, you don't have to agree with us about everything, but vote for us, get us in there, and then we'll work on these other things. Mm-hmm. You can't then turn around and say to those people, well, you voted for this, so you have to, you know, swallow it.
Go ahead, Tom.
That's essentially my point. And just real quick, I wanted to add that the rest of the developed world has figured out how to essentially make it so that people don't die because they can't afford medicine.
Yeah. Tom, thank you for the phone call. And I think that point is correct that he's making about the vice president. Elections do have consequences. But I think even Mahima Iyengar and Michael Marshall would say that not every single person who voted for members of the New York State Senate voted for single payer. So I think it's fair to say large issues are pretty well repped at the polls, and the results of elections, we shouldn't be surprised when they go certain ways. But Tom's point really is fair here. I mean, I think the occupants of the White House now understand that the Democrats as a party have been split on this, and that not everybody who voted for Joe Biden or against Donald Trump said, just keep the Affordable Care Act. So, yeah, I think that point is well taken, Tom, and I think it is more than fair. I'll just ask Mahima and Michael briefly if you want to follow up on that. Go ahead, Mahima.
Yeah, I think that, just briefly that, I think that this like really comes down to in the end how much education we're kind of doing on this issue, and whether or not we're really like presenting our points in a way that are getting across to people that might not necessarily agree with us, like as they were called before, maybe like centrist Democrats. So I think that like if we continue to do our like work and our homework on this, and we keep telling people like really in the end with like a system like this, people are going to end up paying less than they would in the current system, and everyone is going to have health care. If we really continue to broadcast that message and make sure, as Michael was saying before, that this is a people powered movement, and we're all doing our work and calling our senators, writing letters to the editor, hopefully we can keep turning things around, because really there are a lot of people with different opinions. But I think in the end, everyone believes that healthcare is a human right. And we just think that this is the only way to really do that.
Michael, Allie is asking online, do we know which members of the local delegation have formally signed on to the New York Health Act? Do you know that, Michael?
I personally don't have that information at hand, but I know that there is a strong push and a strong interest in that area, because as Mahima just said, the education process is really what's making the difference in this. Because I think part of the last 12 years has been a lot of miseducation and misinformation. So it's very tough for a centrist Democrat or for a common person in the, you know, general public to have a full understanding of these numbers and statistics and so forth. But again, get back to the last caller's point, this is a bread and butter issue. This is a fact of life and death for people. And so you might split hairs as to where you stand in the party or where you fall on, you know, which degree of healthcare you want. But I think it's the statistics bear out. Overall, people want comprehensive healthcare that is affordable and that is sustainable and that covers all people. So I think if we look at this rally that's going to be taking place on March 5th at the Liberty Poll, you'll see that there are a number of elected officials who have come out in support. They may not actually be co-signers on the bill, but they're learning more about the educational process as to what it takes and what it's going to require for the state of New York to go forth. And I would just like to add, because I know we're going to break, at this point in time, I think it's pivotal that we look and see of all of the things that are converging, issues around race, issues around criminal justice, issues around health care, mental health, and so forth. People are really coalescing about the intersectionality of these issues and how they impact their lives. And I think it's one of the things that the elected officials are being made aware of, that it's not a single, you know, split off issue that you can just look at in isolation, but it goes into relation to employment, job security, home security, all other areas of life. Thank you.
Michael Marshall and Mahima Iyeng are with us talking about the New York Health Act, single-payer health care in New York State. After our only break of the hour, we're back to your phone calls and emails. We've got a lot. We're going to work through them with our guests as we better try to understand the current push for a single-payer system in New York State. That's next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're joined by New York State Senator Jeremy Cooney, New York State Assemblyman Damon Meeks. They join us to discuss the new vaccination site in Rochester that for a short while will serve residents from the city and some of the most underserved parts of our community. Should that window be extended? We'll also talk to them about the Prude case, the grand jury's decision, and state business, including their confidence or not in Governor Cuomo. That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Lisa in Rochester is on the phone next. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say a couple things as someone who has worked in healthcare in the revenue cycle aspect of healthcare for over 10 years. I'm a strong supporter of the New York Health Act because I see on a daily basis exactly how many barriers private payers create to people getting the quality care that they need. I see it largely in mental health. Payers will limit the types of providers that can provide care to people. So that means that patients have a harder time finding a therapist that can serve them. And there are just a lot of people hours that go into fighting with these payers to get them to pay for the services that they supposedly cover. I think that if we had a single payer system where the rules were the same for everyone because it was all under one payer, it would cut down on the amount of work that has to just go into negotiating these different rules with different payers. And that time and energy and money could go towards actually getting people the health care that they need and deserve.
Yeah, and Lisa, before I kick it to our guests on this, you know, sometimes we talk about the trade-offs of getting people in front of a doctor and making things more efficient. And, you know, in a moment, I'll read some emails from guests who are a little bit more skeptical of a single-payer system. Their concern is if we move to a government-run healthcare system, you'll be waiting longer to see a doctor, whether you get to see a doctor. You'll be waiting in long queues to deal with elective surgeries and more. You know, how do you see some of the possible trade-offs, or do you think some of them are overblown? I mean, what comes to mind for you?
I think that I don't want to say overblown because I think that puts the wrong light on the people that think those things. But I think that people don't really understand how medical billing and how the revenue cycle in the medical industry works and how complicated it is. We have entire teams of people that spend months and months and months just figuring out how to bill the same service to different insurances because they have different rules. And, you know, now everything is on electronic medical record and electronic billing. So that adds an additional layer of complication to it because these things have to be coded differently to go to Excellus or to MVP or to Medicare or to Medicaid. Even within New York State, you know, we have, you know, Medicaid can have different rules than Excellus, and Excellus has different rules than MVP. And I think that a lot of the cost in healthcare is that you have to have so many people with their hands in this just to figure out how to get it all to work properly. Whereas if you had just one payer with one set of rules about how things get billed, people aren't going to be waiting longer because there's going to be more more people available to set that up and to connect them with the providers that they need and to, you know, to get them where they need to be, to get those appointments made and all of the work that goes into actually getting them that care rather than just dealing with the politics of how payers work.
Sure. Lisa, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate that. And let me send it over now to Mahima Iyengar to start with some response. Go ahead.
Yeah, I really appreciated all of those points. I absolutely agree. Our current system is the epitome of inefficiency. And, you know, even I think I have an example even just from the past hour. During the break, there was an Excellus ad that played. Excellus is making, you know, tens of millions of dollars and spending that money advertising to all of you on this show right now to outcompete other insurance companies instead of using that money to actually provide you healthcare. There's just, I think, and even from a provider standpoint, the bureaucracy of having to deal with, as Lisa was saying, dozens of insurance companies and dozens of insurance systems is extremely inefficient. Having to flip through like a booklet to choose which diabetes medication you can prescribe someone. I think that for like so many different reasons, having a single system would be much more streamlined and make our whole healthcare system run more efficiently. And, you know, the end goal of that is just making sure that people have healthcare.
Michael Marshall, you want to add to that?
Thank you. Lisa, I would also, again, to all the service providers who are working in the healthcare field, the work that you do is invaluable, and we greatly appreciate and honor and respect the work that you do because you serve people. You reach out and you actually touch people and make a difference in people's lives. And I think my response is the number one cause of bankruptcy in the United States is medical debt. The system we have right now is not a healthcare system. It's a profit system. And the other piece is, you know, I was coming down and saying that, you know, the elected officials work for us. And again, they too are public servants. They take great energy and great amount of time in serving their constituents, which I honor and respect. But we also need to make it clear that in this system, it's going to be comprehensive, as Lisa stated. It's not going to be 10 different people telling you how to orchestrate or how to manage the system. It's going to be one set of rules, one set. Now, it'll be tailored to, I would imagine, each state and their needs, but it's not going to be 20 different players looking for the best profit margin that they can make. It's going to be a system that's designed to be efficient. It's going to be a system where we as the public can hold our elected officials accountable, and we can actually see what the procedures and guidelines are that are drafted to implement and carry out these systems. They have to answer to us. We don't have to answer to them. And I think that would be a very important piece in working out and, you know, designing these healthcare systems on a one-payer system.
This is an email from a listener named Roger, who is a doctor in this community who's been serving for a long time. Roger says, the Affordable Care Act is more of an insurance company welfare act than a healthcare act. rural hospitals and rural practices have been closed at accelerated rates since the ACA. The pipeline for psychologists and psychiatrists has not been increased by the ACA. ACA's requirement of 20% drug copay has made healthcare more unaffordable for many. Having insurance but no access to a healthcare provider or a facility is not improved healthcare. That's from Roger. I just want to get Mahima's thoughts on that. And as I send it to you, Tahima, to kind of weigh in on what Dr. Roger is telling us there. I don't know if the doctor is okay with me saying it the last name, but he's a doctor. And what comes to mind too for me, Mahima, is the fact that since the advent of the Affordable Care Act, what we have seen is a pretty dramatic increase in the number of Americans with high deductible insurance. So if your deductible is $6,000, you don't really have health care. You have catastrophic care, but you have the kind of health care in which you may avoid going to the hospital for some pretty serious stuff because you don't want to eat up that $6,000 copay. And, you know, you may try to wait something out at home. You may try to avoid it, hope for the best, and not get the kind of care that you might need. It just strikes me that since the advent of the Affordable Care Act, intentionally or not, we have seen a lot more in the way of high deductible insurance, which to me is more catastrophic insurance. It's not really health care coverage per se. How do you see that, Mahima?
I agree that there's a lot of high deductible plans, and you know, that makes it extremely difficult for people to actually get care. Exactly what you're saying, you know, people come into the emergency room in December when their deductibles have been met, right? And that's not health care. And under the New York Health Act, there would be no copays, there would be no deductibles. People would be able to access their doctor and be able to choose their doctor. I think that, like, in a system like that, people are going to be able to get the kind of care that keeps you from coming into the emergency room because you'll be able to see your doctor on a regular basis. You know, it might not, you know, we certainly have a lot of work to do in terms of convincing, I think, the medical community. But I think that the like newer generation of, you know, doctors and medical students that are coming up right now are very supportive of single payer healthcare because I think we see the inefficiencies in the current system and want to make sure that we can really provide healthcare to everyone regardless of ability to pay.
Well, let me give you both sides of this coin. You know, to Mahima's point about upcoming and newer and younger doctors, there's almost certainly, and I haven't seen the latest surveys, but there's almost certainly more of an interest and a support for a single-payer system than maybe some of their older peers. But that's certainly not exclusive, and I know Mahima's not saying that. But it, just as an example, the Strong Hospital Ethics Committee was on this program recently, and they wrote a public letter echoing the concerns of students, echoing the concerns of the community, following WXXI's reporting about special access for COVID vaccines for big donors to URMC. Now, URMC apologized. They said it was a mistake. They were not going to do it again. The Strong Hospital Ethics Committee said it's not just vaccine access. It's concierge health programs. It's $4,500 out of pocket for a single day of 8 hours of screenings that would normally take 5 months and five doctors to set up. And there was a number of members of the Strong Hospital Ethics Committee who are MDs, who are, you know, not just out of school, who told us on the program that the logical solution for a more ethical system is a single-payer system. So it's interesting to see the shift, but I haven't seen full surveys of that particular job sector, and I would be interested to see it. Now, on the other side, let me read for both Mahima and Michael a couple of emails. David in Irondequoit says, I have heard several references to for-profit medical insurance companies. The two major regional providers are not-for-profit organizations. I have dealt with both of those organizations. They provide very good customer service. I have dealt with Medicare and the Social Security Administration. They were difficult or very difficult to deal with. I am currently struggling to straighten out a problem with state income taxes. I fear a future in which I would be forced to deal either with the federal or state government for my medical insurance. An important basic problem with medical care is that it can be inherently very expensive. People want all of the benefits that modern medicine can provide. That often involves many highly skilled, highly educated people and sophisticated, expensive equipment. Changing the way insurance is provided will not change any of that. And Charles writes to say, wants to send a note saying, let's see here. Charles says, a fact check here. We've already got single-payer health care in the United States. It's a government organization called the Department of Veterans Affairs. They're responsible for the health care of an estimated 7% of Americans. And over the last few years, they've displayed large amounts of issues doing so. I really don't know why I have to keep saying this or how to make people understand, but more government is not the answer. And giving 100% responsibility to an organization that can't handle 7% is insanity. Okay, so Mahima, Mike, I'll start with Mahima. So two very, very different views from David and Charles compared to some of what we've heard this hour. Some concerns about everything from inefficiency, bureaucracy, waiting in line for elective care, quality of care, et cetera. Mahima, what do you think?
So I, first of all, just want to say that the majority of other, like, rich countries in the world do this already, and they have better life expectancies than us. So clearly, like, this is not, you know, something that is new. Other people are doing it, and they're doing it well, and we wouldn't be the first to be doing this. And then I also wanted to point out that people like Medicare. If you look at surveys of folks that are on Medicare, they really, really like Medicare. And life expectancy actually goes up once you get on Medicare versus when you, like, before you're on Medicare. So there's something that the government is doing right with Medicare. And I think that, you know, with a system like this, our main concern is just making sure that everyone has health care. And the current system that we have right now does not do that. And so we clearly need to find a better way to make sure that people have care, people have comprehensive care, and everyone is covered equally and treated equally under the system. And we don't have that system right now.
Michael Marshall, what do you think?
Well, I think the last two requests or emails that were sent in, I think the callers have some very interesting and very poignant points in terms of the systems and the level of bureaucracy that you encounter, whether it be state or private. And I think what we need to understand going forward is that for this to be effective and to be meaningful, that all of our citizenry have to get involved, regardless of your economic or social status. I think the people who are veterans in America who served our country honorably deserve the best treatment and the best care possible with minimal amount of bureaucracy. And I think what happens is that when systems get caught up in number games and get caught up in trying to, you know, perpetuate itself for the sake of itself, they lose sight of the very key issue. Health care is a human right. It is an issue about humanity. It is an issue about taking care of one another, taking care of our grandparents, taking care of our children, taking care of the less fortunate people in society who don't have the education, who don't have the skill set or tools to navigate this complicated system. We don't need government officials who want to just debate and tear apart and destroy something that's helping and caring for American citizens. We need elected officials who are going to get in there and fight on behalf of their citizenry. People of color, elderly people, we are in a position where we are, our lives are at risk and are at stake. And we need people who are going to advocate and stand up for us. I mean, I understand the, you know, the issues and the complications, but I'm not a statistician. I'm not a, you know, an actuary or any of those things. I'm just a citizen in the city of Rochester trying to live, trying to survive. And people's voices collectively can make a difference in terms of holding our elected officials accountable and trying to implement systems that work for all people.
Let me squeeze in two more comments. Kathy says, the drip, drip, drip of decreasing coverage and increasing premiums and raising deductibles started long before the ACA. The changes started in the 1980s when HMOs came in shortly after I got into medicine. Business people are profit-driven and don't belong in a medical system. That's from Kathy. Steve in Penfield. Got to keep it tight on the phone. Go ahead, Steve.
I'll be quick. Thank you very much for taking my call. I am a business owner, and I pay for the health insurance for my employees, so I am concerned about their health and well-being. One thing as a business owner I've always found very confusing to me is why larger corporate entities that pay for health insurance for hundreds, if not thousands of people, why they're not more on the side of single-payer health care. It just blows my mind. You know, when there are arguments between labor unions and corporations, for instance, healthcare is a major topic. This, to me, would be a wonderful solution for those corporate entities. And one last thing, mm-hmm. when people talk to me about having a rationed care system, my answer that as an objection to single payer, my answer is look at the other developed countries around the world. How many of them are protesting saying, take away my national health care? Mm. And that I'll listen for my answer.
Yeah, thank Steve, you. Thank you. Mahima, 30 seconds. Go ahead.
30 seconds. So I think that was a really great point. A lot of small business owners are squeezed by the current system and having to pay for their employees' health care. And under a single payer funded system, employers under the status quo would actually be contributing less per worker in health benefits. So I think that's one really great reason for business owners to support the New York Health Act.
And Mahima, I don't know if you or Michael mentioned, you're going to be somewhere next week. You want to let listeners know if they wanted to join you?
Yeah, we'll be at the Liberty Poll on March 5th at 12 p.m. next week, and we'll be live streaming as well from our Facebook page, Rochester for New York Health.
Mahima Iyengar is a medical student and co-chair of the Rochester Campaign for New York Health. Appreciate your time, and I hope we can talk soon. Thank you, Mahima.
Thank you.
Michael Marshall, volunteer with the Rochester Poor People's Campaign, Rochester Homeless Union, and Metro Justice. Appreciate your time. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much, Evan, and thank you to all your callers and writers in.
You got it. More connections coming up in a moment.